welcome to the WCET Frontiers Podcast, where we talk about solutions and innovations in the practice and policy of digital learning in higher education. My name is Lindsay Downs. I am one of the hosts for today's episode. You heard that right. One of the hosts. For the first time ever, we have a co-host for today's show,
which is my conversation and my new co-host conversation with Karen Cangelosi, the new director of Every Learner Everywhere.
Continuing this season's focus on the journeys we've taken in our higher education and digital learning careers, it was just absolutely wonderful to get to know Karen a little bit more and learn about what led her to join the Every Learner and WCET team. You can learn more about Every Learner Everywhere on their website, everylearnereverywhere.org. And without further ado, here is the WCET Frontiers Pod Season 2, Episode 7, Where I've Been, Where I Am, and Where We're Headed with Karen Cangelosi.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of WCET Frontiers. This is Lindsay Downs, your host for today, and I'm excited because I actually have a co-host on this episode with me, Emily Cook, who is the Manager of Digital Marketing and Communications with Every Learner Everywhere and WCET, is joining me today. Hey, Emily, how's it going?
Hi, Lindsay. It's going great. Thanks for having me. I'm really excited to be here today, joining as a co-host.
I'm excited to have you, too. Should be way more fun, especially because of our guest today. I am so thrilled for us to chat with her. Can you introduce her for us?
We're thrilled to have our new director, Karen Cangelosi, joining us today for Every Learner Everywhere. Karen joined a few months ago and has hit the ground running, and we're really thrilled to have her on the team. And so we'd like to have a little moment to get to know you, Karen. So if you could just introduce yourself and tell us about your background and your history, your education, your hobbies, and then how did you get here to Every Learner Everywhere?
Okay, just a few things. Well, first, I want to thank both Lindsay and Emily for inviting me into the podcast today. I'm thrilled to be here chatting with both of you, and I'm thrilled to be part of this organization. It's a good question, like anyone's journey, as we think about how do we follow those dots from where we started out to how we got to where we are now is kind of an interesting thing. So I have a long background in higher education as a professor of biology. I taught at Keene State College, which is in Keene, New Hampshire, kind of the southwest corner of New Hampshire, where Vermont and New Hampshire and Massachusetts all come together. And so I taught at Keene State for 29 years. It's kind of a long time. And I love teaching. I love being part of a community of faculty. I love doing my scholarship there in biology in the department. My formal training and background in biology is as an arachnologist, which is the study of spiders and other arachnids. And so, yeah, everybody's like, oh no, it's spiders. And so I have done a lot around the behavior of spiders. Behavioral ecology is what we kind of think about it in terms of the field that I was focused in. And so I get a lot of spider questions. As soon as I tell people that I studied spiders, they're like, oh, let me tell you about the one in my bathtub or the one that my grandmother last year. And so I'm happy to answer those questions. I've done a lot of community presentations on the myths and truths of spiders. Fun to talk about that. So I also, as a biologist, I ran a coral reef monitoring research program at Keene State, took students down to the Turks and Caicos Islands. We worked with local high school students on the islands that were just barely learning to swim. We would take them snorkeling and we would teach them about methods of how to monitor the coral reef and to learn about the natural environment in the home and in which they live. And so it's really fun to be part of that project. We collected data for about 12 years on that reef. I'd love to get back to doing that if I ever have any spare time. So marine biology, invertebrate zoology, arachnology, ecology, those were all my areas of specialty. And so I still bring a scientific focus into the work that I do. Having been an educator and having worked with students and having worked with, you know, colleagues, it brought me into thinking more about how can we do this better, right? Like, how can we work with students in ways that really help to improve their learning. You know, there's a lot of people that will say, you know, if you take a look at a classroom and you see a bunch of student desks in the room, and then there's a screen at the back or chalkboard, like it literally looks like it looked 100 years ago. Like, what have we really changed about teaching and our processes of teaching? And of course, you know, sorry.
No, I just said not much. Yeah.
I mean, in some ways, like some of the tools have changed. Like we're in digital learning, so we're talking about technologies and tools. And in a lot of ways, even though we have fancier tools, our practices are not that changed dramatically. So just kind of talking with colleagues and thinking about how we really do a better job of what it means to engage students in the classroom. How do we get their thoughts? How do we get their leadership? How do we really promote their agency in learning? Brought me into the world of open education. And I know that most people sort of associate open education with open educational resources or OER. And that's a big part of it. Like trading out commercial textbooks for free stuff was huge. You know, I spearheaded a movement so that we swapped out like all of the biology textbooks at Keene State for free and open educational resources. And we saved our students hundreds of thousands of dollars. Science textbooks cost students a lot of money. We worked on getting the chem department, some of the math department, some of the other departments. And so trading out overpriced books that are at 3-4 times the rate of inflation for free OER, it was a tremendous help to students. But it wasn't only about OER. One of the reasons I was really excited about open education is because of the ways in which it centers a different way of thinking about teaching practices. So for me, the open educational practices or the open pedagogies were the more important and the more exciting. Like saving students money is awesome, but we could think about other ways to save students money, and we should be thinking about that. But the ways in which we interact with our students in the classroom, how we center their humanity, how we allow them to have more control over their own learning processes is part of open pedagogy. And it's open because it's also about students sharing. How do they take things that they've learned and that they create? And so we talk a lot in the open pedagogical world about students contributing knowledge instead of just consuming it. Like, how do my students create something and share it out to communities, whether it's local, regional, or even global, so that it adds value to the world instead of here's a bunch of facts, memorize them, let me dump this into your brain, and then you spit it back out on a test later. So those kinds of open pedagogical practices that allow students to be contributors and allow them to add value to the world and open up their work, share it out with an open license that others can use, that became the basis of the kind of work that I was doing in my own classroom and the work that I did in faculty development at Keene State as I ran the Faculty Enrichment Center for a little while there, worked with colleagues to look at the confluence of open pedagogy and digital learning and pedagogical practices more generally. And so when I left Keene State a little bit early, with an early retirement, it was to seek out an opportunity that became available with Open Education Global. And I worked for Open Education Global for 2 years and ran what's called the Regional Leaders of Open Education Network, or ARLO. And ARLO, we have a paper, a publication that's coming out in the Journal of OERHE, Journal of Open Educational Resources in Higher Education. And it's just in that press stage where it's been accepted for publication, and they're putting the last bells and whistles on it. And hopefully that will be out pretty soon. And so what we did in ARLO is we supported faculty and staff from over 60 to 100 institutions, or participants from 60 some institutions, to create strategic plans in order to bring more open educational practices into their institutions. Oh, wow. So that's what I did in ARLO. And then when that grant period ended and I was thinking about what to do next, you know, it's opposed to going back to Keene State, I decided to take that retirement and just sort of see what the other opportunities were out there. And then I saw the actually a friend of mine sent me the ad for the Every Learner, Everywhere director and said, hey, Karen, you know what? You'd be perfect for this.
Nice.
And I looked at it and I said, okay, yeah, maybe I'll give that a whirl. And so that's kind of how I got from point A to point B today. Yeah.
Well, thank you, Karen's friend, for sending that. We're so thrilled to be able to work with her. I absolutely love that background, and thank you for sharing it with us. I really enjoyed what you said about figuring out ways to bring students' agency into the learning experience, and especially when they're contributing to knowledge and kind of adding to the world. You know, how much better, more interesting for you as the instructor and for the students as the learners, and then for them after they're done with college, they can actually show, or after they're done with whatever degree they're accomplishing or curriculum they're accomplishing, to show what they've learned to to future employers and everything. So that's wonderful. Thank you. Interestingly enough, my we'll end the episode with something we're learning about. It's about spiders, which I have an interesting relationship with. And so I think that's funny. And I do want to send you some pictures and ask you to identify them for me.
Awesome. I can talk about spiders all day long. So
great. So that's good. So I think Emily asked you too a little bit about hobbies. Can you share some of your interesting hobbies?
Sure.
Other than spiders?
Other than spiders. Yeah, the spiders are, I guess they've turned in less of a career, more of a hobby these days. But I love playing music. Being a musician is a big thing for me. I always hesitate to say that because that assumes that people will think that I'm really good at it. I find I like to say that I'm kind of okay. Like I like to play. I have to play for fun. We organize jam sessions. My partner, Marianne, and I like to have friends over to the house, and we have lots of musicians. So we'll have guitar players and ukulele players. And I also play a little bit of harmonica and people that sing and bring the keyboard. And so I love music, and I love music in groups in particular. Yes. I like to have music playing being part of community. And so we'll also sometimes organize karaoke parties where we, instead of playing the music ourselves, we'll put up the karaoke on YouTube and everybody will sing. And we have some, you know, little cheap microphones that are really fun. And so engaging people in music is super important. I also love nature and the outdoors. Of course, being an ecologist, you know, loving to be outside, loving hiking. I love swimming. I love kayaking. I love biking. I love camping. I used to do a lot more camping in my older days than I do now. But all of those kinds of things are super important to me as well.
Oh, that's great.
Well, here, the combination, like singing around the campfire, was a really big piece. So,
Emily, any other questions about getting to know Karen?
I think so. I think it was a wonderful overview of your journey so far, and I'm really interested to hear a little bit more about the now.
Yeah, perfect segue. We wanted to chat a little bit about what's going on now. You're now the new director of Every Learner Everywhere. Mm-hmm. Well, not brand new. You've been there for a little while, but I'm curious what's inspiring you now in your role? What's keeping you motivated? What's exciting?
Hey, yeah, no, those are good questions. And, you know, Russ and I were talking about, like, how long do I get to claim the new card? You know, so I started in June. It's new-ish, but not brand new anymore. And so it's been a real learning journey for me. One of the things is I'm incredibly grateful for the amazing team that I have, like, that I've learned, like, how folks are so committed to this work and how hard they work and how they bring all kinds of fresh ideas all the time. I could go on and on about my coworkers, and that's like being part of a collaborative team is important to me. I feel like I've done that in my work in Arlo. I did that in my work at Keene State. I do that in my community groups. Like, I don't feel like any one person, even if you're the leader, even if you're the director, can hold all of it. Like, you have to work with a team of people. You have to find ways to really support and grow collaborative efforts and collaborations. So I'm really interested in keeping on building that, right? So Every Learner, it's a network. And so it's about that. Like, we have a network of partners and partner organizations. And I've been spending a lot of my time on a so-called partner tour, where I have a lot of Zoom meetings, meeting people that are the leads and other members of some of the partner organizations, just asking them, what do you do? What do you think is important? How can every learner be supporting what you're doing? How do you think we can be building this network? And that's the, we're going to continue that, those kind of discussions with each other about what our network can do, what it means, how we can keep growing together. As you know, we're funded primarily by the Gates Foundation. And so there are certain kinds of mandates that we have to follow. Some of those mandates involve things that I'm super excited about, like bringing on board equity first organizations. So that's how the Gates Foundation has a particular definition of, like, what does it mean for an organization to be equity first? A lot of that has to do with the representation of the leadership of that organization, as well as the staff. What is the racial diversity and makeup? But it's also about the mission and the work and the programming and the, you know, the priorities for that organization around equity. So it makes perfect sense for every learner who is all about equitable digital learning to be bringing in more partner organizations that are specifically focused around those things. And so I've been having some conversations, and me and some of the other folks on the team having conversations about how to identify those organizations, how to create an equitable application for organizations to fill out to become part of the network, and that we have some funding from the foundation to be able to do this. So that's one thing I'm really excited about right now. I mean, we do a lot of different things. The student internship program that Emily and Patty put together is really fantastic. We had something like more than 60 applications for, what, 5 slots, was it, Emma?
Wow. Yep, exactly. Yeah, close to 70 applications for only 5 slots. So it's getting notoriety, I guess.
Yeah. So in our student, we really want to figure out, we really want to walk this talk of student leadership. Like, what does it mean not to just say, oh, let me put you on a panel and ask your opinion, but how do we really integrate the thoughts and ideas of those students into the work that we do? How can we even more intentionally connect student thought leadership with the ways in which we do things within Every Learner, and perhaps even with WCET more broadly? We talked about that at our retreat too, right?
We
how
do
we
yeah.
look at those connections? So we're excited about that.
Wait, so we should actually talk with basically our customers about how they want us to make it better for them? What?
What? You mean members, or you mean, yeah. So.
Yeah.
Or clients. Or.
Yeah, client, whatever you want to call them. But
I never liked calling students customers or clients, actually, though. So they're students.
Yeah, they are. But I like what you're communicating there, is that we're getting them involved in,
yeah,
in the education that's so important to changing their lives. And something that they have to invest a lot of effort in to be successful. So makes sense.
But you're right, things. Lindsay. Like, oh, what a good idea. We should actually ask students what they need.
Yeah,
what they like need. That's some kind of brilliant insight, as opposed to something that should be imminently obvious.
Yeah. Well, that's so exciting. Yeah, and I am hoping here soon, Emily, and I think it's my fault we haven't done it yet, but that we'll be able to get with Patty and schedule another episode to chat about that internship program, and maybe even chat with some of your students. So that'd be really neat to learn about that.
Yeah, we'd love to do that and incorporate the students in that conversation and have them tell their stories and their experiences through the program.
That'd be great. Well, how exciting, especially about that convening and the new kind of designation of those different equity first partners. What a designation. I like that a lot. You know, I was also kind of interested in, you know, one of the reasons why we focused on professionals' journeys this season here at the podcast is to help others understand that journey towards success and how they can also be successful in their journey, right? So what's something that you've learned? It can be recent, or that you've learned in your other roles that you think everybody should know at some point in their life, that everybody should learn?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of hard to speak for what everybody should learn. But I know that something that I feel has been important for me is to question everything Like, I think we often take a lot of things at face value and assume that that is just the way that it is. You know, oftentimes people say, well, that's just how it's done. That's just what we have. One of the things I used to do when I would go into my classroom is, you know, we would talk about the show, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, right? And the assumption was, well, of course everybody does. And so I said, well, you know, why? Like, why do we really all want to be millionaires? Do we all need to be millionaire? Like, what are the consequences of everybody wanting to be a millionaire or everybody becoming a millionaire? Like, what is the impact? Like, just question what everybody always just assumes to be the truth or the reality of the place in which we live. I think that can really just turn things around in how we look at things. Like, why is our organization structured the way it is? Why do we spend money on this instead of that? Why can't we do it a different way? And so I can drive people crazy by being a little bit of a nonconformist and saying, I don't want to do it that way. And I've learned to also take a step back and say, okay, I know there are rules, you know, but question rules and regulations. Like, why are they there? And if they don't work for us, that we should find other ways to change them.
That's the perfect point of being still new, right? Is that you're learning those for the first time. So it's like the perfect opportunity to really be like, okay, but why?
And even if you've been in an organization for 50 years, you can question why you're doing it.
That's true.
And it's
we all should
change. Yeah.
Yeah, we all should.
I love that.
I think you get at least a year to be new.
Oh, that's great. That sounds good. Yeah. So then I can make mistakes like, oh, I didn't know I was new. I'm new.
I didn't know. I'm still new. Whoops. Can you help me?
I didn't know that was a rule. Sorry. I'm new.
Yeah. Awesome. So building on your experience and your journey and your newness at Every Learner and what you've learned throughout your career and what you're learning about Every Learner. And yes, we love, you know, the collaborative nature of the organization and how we work as a team and as a network and with our partner and parent organizations as well. So we just like to talk a little bit now that you've, you know, been here for a little while, what your thoughts are on what's coming up next for Every Learner, you know, how you're thinking about your journey and Every Learner's journey moving forward and looking ahead to the future a little bit.
Yeah. Again, I hope to be thinking about that future in concert with the other team members. And I spoke to this a little bit in terms of the Equity First organizations that we're hoping to bring on board. So we're in the process of trying to figure out how we're going to do that and who we're going to bring on. But once we do, we'll have really awesome opportunities to say, okay, now that these organizations are here, what is it that they bring? What are they going to do? What are the different kinds of so-called services that we have on our website? And I have to also say that, like, just the word services was new for me to think about in the context of higher education. Like, why we talk about learning opportunities, you know, or classrooms or workshops, but services is sort of an interesting side of the higher,
which means that we're helping to serve others,
and it's not necessarily about things. So what are the new development side of the world that we can bring in terms of equity, in terms of digital learning? Definitely, I want us to be thinking more and more about AI because everybody's thinking about it. Everybody's talking about it. There's a lot of information coming from lots of different venues, lots of different angles. There's a lot of confusion out there. I want Every Learner to really play a major role in helping to vet some of that information. We know that Van Davis, who's doing that for WCET, is also within the Every Learner organization who will, you know, work with us to help figure that out. But there's a lot of other people that are in the world really thinking about how AI is operating. And so that's something that we can think about. In terms of thinking about the future for Every Learner too, as I mentioned, we're funded primarily through the Gates Foundation. You know, so we think about Every Learner as being delivery, like how do we take things that have been developed and help deliver and provide it for colleges and institutions? But can't Every Learner also have a role in some of the development piece of it, especially in terms of providing input in terms of what is really equitable digital learning. So thinking about what are the roles that we can play. And the reason for this is to think about not just our long-term sustainability, but to think about our growth in terms of not just getting bigger, but expanding into the kinds of things that we can do. What are the marginalized populations we can reach? Gates is very focused on gateway courses. Perhaps we can think about avenues to look at courses that are a little bit higher level, just for an example. There's just a lot of things that we could provide and do. Even though we have a lot of services there, there's so much more. Well, this is just like dreaming, you know, not any specific plans right now. We're just in that phase of thinking about what's possible, what might we be able to do, what should we prioritize, and working together with our team and with our partners to decide all that so that we can put our energies and our focus towards those particular areas. So that's kind of where I'm at right now. I'm happy to answer any follow-ups on anything that I just said.
Yeah, I love it. You're just bringing back that asking questions. It's your asking questions and brainstorming period, right?
Yeah, and a little bit of planning too.
Yeah, planning too. That's great. Sounds like you're really thinking hard about how to have the most impactful impact. How to have the biggest impact on students that you can.
We're working on it, yeah, for sure. biggest impact on students and a bigger reach. I like to think bigger about reach. Yeah, I like to think about scale. People often vision scale as just getting bigger, better, more, moving up. And I think scaling is also about diversification. It's about spread. Like you can't just take something and magnify it and then expect it to work for everybody. We have different kinds of institutions. We have different kinds of students. We have 2 years and 4 years and privates and publics. And so something that works in this context may not work in another context. And so scaling has to really involve that sort of customization, individualization, that thinking about specific kinds of needs and for learners, and can we keep creating those sorts of services or those kinds of processes that those populations need and just keep adding to our repertoire of what we can deliver? Maybe we can think about scale a little bit more horizontally instead of vertically.
Yeah, I like that way of thinking about it. Those are all the questions we had so far, other than our finale question. Did you have anything else you were kind of hoping to chat about or to bring up?
I can't think of anything. I know I talk for a while. I know I can talk a lot. I never have a shortage of ideas and, you know, I think creativity in terms of what we can do. And sometimes it's just a bit more about let's focus in on what makes sense for now.
But I like the pie in the sky moment too. You know, you never know what's going to resonate with someone or capture their interest or inspire them too. That's kind of my favorite part of the process is the planning part. Well, thank you so much, Karen, for going over your journey and sharing all of that with us. As we've chatted about, I like to end each of our Frontiers episodes chatting about something that we have learned recently. Big proponent of lifelong learning, right? And yeah. I think that learning can come in the form of big professional accomplishments or just small things you learn, something new every day that gets you interested in a new topic. I'll go first since I'm asking you to do something. So I mentioned coincidentally, I wanted to share something my mother-in-law, shout out to my mother-in-law, Kathy, who does listen. Thanks, Kathy. She and I were sitting outside the other day when she was visiting. We saw a spider web, which I called a spider web. And we had kind of a fun little discussion about that spider webs and cobwebs might be different things. And so if the spider is still inhabiting the web, then it's a spider web. And then if it's an old kind of dusty, dirty one, then it's a cobweb. And I never had thought about that could be different. And Karen, when we chatted a little bit about this earlier, you had some other information on that. So can you share with us about that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, just to say that, like, the word, you know, cobweb versus regular web, like, there aren't necessarily super scientific definitions for some of the more common language that we use. Although you will see, actually, when I think about it, you will see the word cobweb associated with certain families of spiders. But also the idea that old spider webs that have been abandoned, because spiders will clean their webs. And some spiders, wow, some families, some species of spiders will rebuild their web every single day. The orb weaving spiders will eat the spiral part of the web to recycle, wow, the proteins in that silk and then rebuild it every morning. So so those webs stay clean and fresh and strong. So webs that have been sitting around collecting dust definitely aren't occupied. And so we tend to call those cobwebs. But the word cobweb has been used for even newer webs of spiders in the family Theridiidae, by the way. I'm happy to talk about spiders. The work that I did with spiders and things like that, but maybe that might be too boring for people.
No, no, I think that's interesting. Cool. Well, who wants to share their thing they've recently learned next?
Emily, you want to go first?
Oh, sure. So some people might know, but not the majority. I also teach on the side. I teach marketing, so in my trade. And I just learned, and I'm a little embarrassed as a digital marketing SME, if you will, that I did not know the real name for a hashtag is actually an octothorpe. So there's a technical term for the symbol of a hashtag. And octo comes from the 8 points. They are actually not sure where Thorpe comes from. There's a couple theories, but even Merriam-Webster is not quite sure, and they don't say for certain. But yeah, I found that fascinating, and I actually can't wait to share that with my students this semester.
Very cool. Well, yeah, you both have much more interesting little factoids. I should have thought a little bit more about this question in advance. I'm thinking about something that I just learned this morning in a meeting with some of my colleagues from the Rios Foundation, and we were just chatting about things, and we were chatting about chatting, and we were chatting about chatbots. And one of the things I learned is that some colleges, I won't name any names, are starting to use chatbots in the place of academic advisors. So right. That's kind of, yeah, it's kind of alarming in some circles. It's a little bit, some people are like really, some faculty are really mad about that, sort of freaked out about it. It's an experiment in process to try to figure out, like, are there some things that maybe chatbots could answer, like in terms of simple questions, but students need human academic advisors probably at some point, maybe the thinking as well. So anyway, the fact that we're just starting to see chatbot technology in student and academic advising circles was a brand new thing that I learned this morning. So whatever your thoughts are about that, yeah. It seems to be happening.
So interesting. Everything from answering a quick chat message on, you know, a customer service one to all the way up to advising, huh?
It's interesting. In my class yesterday, I shared with students that some of the marketing trends to watch for and chatbots is not going away anytime soon was one, yeah, of the trends. And so it's fascinating to hear kind of it applicable in that space. I mean, it all comes back to the build, right? The manual build behind the chatbot and how robust it can be. But hopefully the best practice and the model is that it helps with, you know, only so much, and then connects them with a human advisor to help.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that it, again, it's always like the way the tools get used. Maybe they can answer simple questions like how many sections of English 101 are still open,
right?
Versus what do I do about my roommate who's driving me crazy? Like, they're very different questions.
Very different. Yeah. Or where do I go for blank? You know, where's the registrar's office? They can give me the building. And that would be, give a lot more time to staff to answer the roommate questions.
And also, I think being really transparent that if you're talking to a robot versus a human, because that can get confusing for people too. And there, I know there's more and more legislation around like being very clear that this was generated by an AI source and as a person. And so, so we went in the context of education, we're going to have to be thinking about all these things as well.
Great point. Let us know if we're talking to a human or not.
I can't
say tell anymore, purpose, right?
Yeah, I was going to say, for the purposes of this podcast, I can say that Lindsay, Emily, and I are all actual humans.
Yes. We are. And with that, I just want to tell you both, thank you so much for being here and having this great, real human conversation today. And it was just really fun to talk to you, Karen. I'm, again, so thrilled to be able to work with you and have you on the team. Emily, great as always. Thanks for co-hosting with me today.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we'll catch y'all on the next episode.